From the Quackalope Network headquarters, this is the Weekly Quack with Board Game Co., your ultimate source for what's happening around the board game pond. In this week's installment, we talk about a game of interstellar proportions, uncover the latest en route, and embark on a quest of limitless imagination.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Weekly Quack. I'm one of your hosts, Jam, because in with me is Alexander, Let's Be Frank, Buskill the Muskrat, Sender Randolph the Third from North Undershire, Point 63, Bordy McBoardface, Jackson Harris, ASR3, and I just want to say
No. We'd remove Jackson Harris.
Oh. We did, but I do want to say thank you to the Dice Tower for donning a new name on Alex, which is now Randolph. So thank you very much for that. And I think it was Tom Vassell that did that. So great job.
Yeah. And for context there, Alex Randolph is a board game designer, a relatively famous board game designer with a lot of titles to his name. So it wasn't like a confusion of Radcliffe versus Randolph. It was just muscle memory of which Alex R is being referenced.
And I'm pretty confident that it is already established fact in this community that anytime Tom Vassell says anything, it is law. And so, therefore, your name has been changed.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm totally cool with it. I thought my first thought was literally, this is going to make its way to the Weekly Quack, and I am okay with that.
And I gotta say, I think I prefer it. I'm sorry for Radcliffe, but Randolph just, like, it suits you better, Alex. It's just, it suits you so that much
absolutely.
Better.
Absolutely. I'm just gonna have to figure out how to get that board game table renamed now.
And with that, thank you so much for joining us on today's show. And for those of you who are new to the Weekly Quack, welcome. This is a board game variety podcast organized into three main segments. Shell for Sell, where we debate whether a game is either entering or leaving our collections. The Medley Minute, a quick reprise about board game news and other musings. And On the Radar, where we discuss upcoming games and why we're excited for them. Also, at the end of every show, we take some time to go through your feedback and questions. But before we get going, if you like what you hear, be sure to leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from, and above all, to comment on theweeklyquack.com, because we want your questions and we want to hear from you. But with that, how about we get started, everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. And so today, I'm going to start off with my Shell for Sell, which is going to be a game called Mutants by Lucky Duck Games. Mutants is going to be... Wait, what? What? Go ahead.
Why?
Why
are
you...
Yes, why are you bringing this?
An excellent question.
A 1-4 player max genetics to create the ultimate warriors and demonstrate their powers in the arena by dominating the arena and freezing the most valuable mutants. You gain victory points, and whoever gets the most of them wins. I found that
wow,
on the page.
Good job, cool. Jesse. Good job. This is going to be a 2019 games by Lucky Duck Games, and following the tradition of many, but not all of Lucky Duck Games, this is going to be based on an app called, suspiciously enough, ooh, Mutants. And in this game, like Jesse said already, 1-4 players are mixing genetics. What you're going to have is you're going to have a starting hand of various mutants, effectively, simple mutants, and you're going to utilize them to build out more complicated, complex mutants that you'll be drafting before the game begins. You're drafting your own unique pool of mutants with their own unique combination of abilities and how they work together. And then throughout the course of 5 rounds, you're slowly using your core mutants to build out a more diverse, more powerful deck, and then use those to both, you know, get your own points and put things in your freezer, which is ultimately a way of, I guess, basically saving genetic points or whatnot, and attacking other players for domination in their arena so you can get more points that way. It's basically going to be rinse, repeat, using each of their combinations. Each of these mutant classes is going to bring some sort of special ability to the table, whether it's the ability to save mutants, whether it's the ability to deal more raw damage, whether it's drawing and cycling cards. They all have their unique flavor, and it's the combination of how you utilize those cards together that is what's producing the game at the core of Mutants.
So Alex, first question around this. Is the combination between genetics almost like a smash up in any way?
I would say not. Smash up to me, I don't have an easy answer. Instinctively, I'm saying not, but it's really just, I would say the combination of the genetics is, like I said, each one brings its own flavor, which technically Smash Up does as well. But whereas Smash Up is shuffling different decks together, in Mutants, you're going to have cards that are each individual card, meaning the advanced mutants that you draft at the beginning of the game are basically combinations of two different types. So it's not just a combination of cards, but rather cards themselves are a combination of different genes.
Okay, but you're not choosing these sets of cards. They're just kind of pre-made.
To an extent, the cards you draft will be the choices you make at the beginning.
Now, Alex, how central are powers and abilities to the core conceit of this game?
I would argue it's the entire game. The entire game is based around a bunch of cards with powers and abilities. There's really nothing else in this game other than powers and abilities.
Why did you decide? So first of all, I'm out of every single Lucky Duck game, and I know this is going to sound a bit harsh, but of every single Lucky Duck game that I've ever seen, this one is the one that never caught my attention. There was something about it, maybe the artwork or maybe just the gameplay itself. Maybe it was just like a card game that really didn't seem that different from other things I've played before, that I've been completely disinterested in this one. So I'm genuinely surprised that you're bringing it in.
I'm curious why that is. It's rated a 7.5 on BoardGameGeek. That's not an insignificant rating at all. Well, I don't know why you're being so dismissive, Jan.
I think for me, it largely has to do with the artwork across the board just isn't quite something that draws my attention. And the cover art for me is a little bit jumbled with how many different characters they have fit onto this scene, all of which I'm not familiar with. But that being said, about Lucky Duck titles, in the past, I've also written off other titles like Jetpack Joyride or Vikings Gone Wild, and they've surprised me.
Yeah, Jetpack Joyride is also like a 7.1. Vikings Gone Wild, I don't remember its exact score, but it's somewhere in the range. Fruit Ninja.
I remember enjoying it.
Yeah, Fruit Ninja might be the worst of their titles. I don't remember what that one's rated, but I certainly haven't heard anything particularly positive about it.
So, Alex, why did you decide to play this one in the first place? Like, did you get this one explicitly for the purpose of covering it here? Was it just one of these trades that you got in from Board Game Co?
No, that's an excellent and very relevant question. I mean, I've been keeping this one secret and close to my heart, but I was also completely and totally wrote off Mutants when I first heard about it. I completely ignored its existence and did not care for it at all and didn't make any effort to pick it up because something about it just did not strike me as a game worthy of playing. I don't know what exactly
it
was.
I couldn't imagine.
But I'm right there with you. I've been listening this whole time and agreeing with all of you. But then I saw a note from One Stop Co-op Shop on Facebook saying how he actually really enjoyed Mutants, and it seemed like it was in his collection. It seemed like it was a game that he was really enjoying and still actually owned, and not just like one of those, hey, it's good and time to move on from it. And so that's why, because of his testimonial on Facebook, I decided to pick it up.
So I'm ready to guess. Powers and abilities, bringing it into a show. I mean, a company that has repeatedly surprised me with games that I've written off, and a shared experience, despite the point that you didn't steal it from your neighbor's house like I did. I think you're keeping this one.
And Alex, how many people did you play it with?
Three people, and I played it once.
And how many dueling card games do you own?
Oh, I don't know. It depends what you count as dueling card games. I tend to be kind of critical with them, but I also, like, it depends if you count Battle Line, Hanamakoji, Blitzkrieg. I don't know exactly what you consider. Mage Knight, exactly. I don't know exactly how far down the rabbit hole you consider dueling card games to go, so I'm going to just take a pass on that answer.
Okay. I would be genuinely surprised if you're keeping this one. I'm going to go
for
Cell.
Oh, okay, that's a vote. Great, excellent, cool. Vote's locked in. Ding, 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 ding. I'm absolutely keeping this
one. Yes!
This is so ridiculously good.
Powers and abilities. You were so open-ended with that answer that I was like, of course he's holding on to it.
I just doubled down. It's so clearly and openly just baiting you, daring you not to.
All it is powers and abilities. I'd say the entire conceit of the game is powers and abilities. If this was a package of salt, it'd just be all powers and abilities.
So it's even better than that. This is a game.
Anyone that hasn't listened to the show before, Alex likes powers and abilities.
Just a tad. And so this is a game. You think this is going to be a game where I read the rules. I got all set to prepped and whatnot. I wasn't like completely sold based on the rules, but I was certainly intrigued. And like that combined with knowing that other people have liked and enjoyed this game. And then I set it up and proceeded to teach it to the two people, my wife and one of our friends at the table. Both of them the whole way through kept giving me that stare of death that begs me to question whether we should be playing the game. And I multiple times gave them the out. Like, are you sure? Because I can play the solo. I can find other players. Are you sure you want to play this? And they're like, yep. Yes, let's just get it over with. It was unbelievable the degree to which they were just giving me that eye of death. And in the first round of the game, my wife even managed to throw a little. I was telling her about how the cards combo and whatnot, and she like literally looked at me and like put her hands up in the air and was like, whoop whoop, like she was literally had no interest in the game whatsoever.
I'm waiting on the mid review turnaround at this point.
The mid review turnaround is to the extent that at one point she referenced something about a card, and I was like, oh, I'm surprised you read the card when you drafted it, you seem that disinterested. She's like, I didn't, I just drafted them based on the pictures. And like, she literally was completely uninterested in the game. And then in the second round of the game, she suddenly like, I'm enjoying the way these cards work together, and I'm enjoying the way I'm kind of stomping on both of your heads with these powers and abilities that seem so interesting. And she progressively went from the most disinterested I've ever seen her in a board game to, we're just waiting to play it again. We actually almost played it again the same day, but unfortunately things got interrupted. But we are
Do you think it is our speculation that it's just something about the art and the box cover that doesn't draw in, you know, us?
Yeah. I don't know exactly what it is, because when I actually look at it now, there's nothing that's pushing me away. But I am with you. I've seen this title before, and I literally just wrote it off as being a game that was not going to hit my table, that I was not going to get. I completely wrote it off. And it took someone else whose opinion I respected saying, no, this is a good game, before I got it. And then playing it, I mean, this game was good enough that it overcame two people who had strongly negative opinions towards the game as they were playing.
And even Unicorn Fever couldn't do that. So this is remarkable.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, that's another topic. Jesse actually gave Unicorn Fever a try again, Alex. He picked it out.
And I tried it again. I enjoyed it quite a bit more than I did originally.
He still doesn't like it. He doesn't like it, but he enjoyed it a lot more.
Fun fact, the publisher who sent me Unicorn Fever, I shot him a message because I just did my review of it recently. I shot it over to him, and he said, thanks. I saw the review go up over the weekend. Also, I enjoyed your vigorous defense of the game on the Weekly Quack. So the publisher listens to the Weekly Quack. So hi, Colin. How's it going? Apparently, Jesse decided to play it again and actually likes it.
I did. I did try it again. I gave it a fair shake.
It was great fun.
It was fun. It was a good late night party style game. I'm not seeking it out for myself. I'm not asking to play it again, but I wouldn't begrudge someone from doing so. That being said, should I re-steal Mutants from my neighbor? I gave it back to them after some...
Apparently.
You didn't have it? Well, yeah, get it back.
After some breath of time, I felt bad for taking their copy. Should I return it and then play it with them? Should I take it back from them? What's the approach here?
I think
here?
We should play it, Jesse.
Well, it depends. When you borrowed it, how much was it worth, and did you sell it, and now were you waiting for the price to drop before you return it?
I don't sell anything. Borrow would be a stretch. I mean, I genuinely stole it from their front porch, and I did return it, but I now...
After the price dropped.
Well, after the price dropped, and now I'm just questioning whether or not I should re-break into their house and steal it, or if I should just have a conversation with them and ask to play it.
Okay, Jesse, think about your burglary after the show. Alex, I'm really curious as to...
I don't know where I decided to go down on a route of I've stolen games from my neighbor before. Such a weird strand, but we're going with it. That's the theme of this episode, apparently.
Alex, I'm curious as to how a card game played with multiple people, right? But usually when games are head-to-head like this, it can either be great or it could be absolutely awful. It obviously sounds like it's great, but I wanted to hear from you why it was great. And above all, how the interplay of the of those powers is actually being produced in the table. I really like the idea that a card is always pushing another one and creating like a chain effect to the left or to the right. You know, that seemed really interesting. So could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, effectively, every single round, you're going to play a card. There's a few different ways you can play a card, because you can either build a new mutant and then play it, or you can play a card from your hand, or you can save a mutant for next round at a cheaper rate, effectively. And then from there, the card in the active slot is going to push down to the left or the right, because every time a card enters the board, it has an enters play ability, and whenever it leaves the board, it has a leaves play ability. So you're slowly creating the sequencing of this chain of your abilities that will take place, but along the way, you can knock down other opponent's mutants, which effectively means you're stopping their leave a play's ability from taking place, which can, and I can testify this, can be incredibly frustrating as you try to play the game and trigger your combos, and your opponents, otherwise known as your wife, is constantly targeting and knocking down your mutants so that you can't get anything done. And it's basically, it's a chaining of these abilities, and then of course the way you drafted the synergies in things. So you might have a mutant that, for instance, rewards you with extra power every time you cycle cards, which is draw and discard. And then from there, you obviously want to build a deck that is around cycling cards, because those things will play off of each other. And you're usually going to want to choose two or three of these aspects that all tie together to give you that competitive advantage of how your things interplay better than other players interplay.
And in regards to the player count?
The player count. So it was really solid with three players. I don't know how it would play with two yet, because I've only given it one shot. I imagine it would play just fine with two. The way it works is you're not actually really dealing direct damage most of the time. Most of the time, your negative effects will target all opponents. And what you're usually doing is you're trying to augment your power up on this track, which will be how you score points at the end of the round. So it usually ends up managing to work, because you're not really doing a direct damage dealing kind of situation. And the negative effects, when applied, apply equally.
Wow, okay, so I guess I have to try mutants, and should I give Jetpack Joyride a try? I've had it in my
it
in my closet for a bit now.
I've had it on my shelf, and I've read the rules, and I have not got to the table yet.
Oh, you're both missing out. It isn't an instant classic, but they did a great job at translating the feeling of that video or that app into the tabletop experience. I was genuinely disinterested in it until I sat down at a convention and played it. And very, very charmed by it. I mean, it sounds very similar to a lot of these app-based games. Maybe the theming of them doesn't initially strike a chord, but the production and gameplay and just responsibility that Lucky Duck takes when it comes to bringing an IP to the table, they do better than most in terms of executing on something I didn't expect to love.
Well, yeah, that's great.
Overall, been impressed.
Good for Lucky Duck. I definitely got to give these a try. And with that said, I'm bringing in a game that we've actually already talked about, but not in this segment.
We've talked about it like four times.
Well, sort of. We talked about it first that it was announced, then we talked about it on the radar, and now we've completed the cycle, and we're bringing it to Shelf or Sell to determine finally what's up with this game, and it's called Cubitos.
Nice.
Yeah,
Cubitos.
And I'm going to be a little bit biased here. I knew this one was coming in. We played this one together over the weekend. And so I'm just going to see what Alex has to say.
You played it over the weekend with Jan.
I did.
Yes.
And so you know how this is playing out.
I do know.
Interesting.
And we actually played it at the optimum player count, which is four players.
Interesting. So Cubitos is getting a lot of rave feedback from various people. Coming in at 7.9 on Boarding View currently, I've been seeing more and more people who have gotten their hands in it have nothing but positive things to say about the game. And I don't know where the two of you will fall, because, I mean, Jesse's just a rebel. Jan is often torn between...
Is that all I am?
Yeah, just a
rebel. I'm also a bit of a fanatic.
A fanatic rebel. I'm cool with that. And so this game, I mean, just instinctively, I'm going to say, based on the other people's opinions that I've seen, I expect that it delivered on what you're looking for. I do not know... I think you thought it was a solid game. Did you think it was a solid game worth keeping is a different conversation versus a solid game that you can move on from? I'm going to say that you are getting rid of it,
and
contrary to the instinctive approach I have.
For the audience, Jan, set up what this game is.
Yeah, so Cubitos is a push-your-luck, back-building racing game designed by John D. Clare and published by AEG. Aptly compared to a combination between Quest for El Dorado and Quacks of Quedlinburg, in Cubitos, players take on the role of participants in the annual Cube Cup, a race of strategy and luck to determine the Cubitos champion. Each player has a runner on the racetrack and a support team, which is represented by all the dice you roll. Each turn, you and the other players roll dice simultaneously and use their results to move along the racetrack, buy new dice, and use abilities. However, you have to be careful not to bust. Once you roll at least three dice with faces on them, any subsequent new rolls that you do showing all blanks will make you bust, causing you to go up a fan track, which gives you some type of compensation, but ultimately you just waste an entire round otherwise. Whoever reaches the finish line first wins the game. So, Jesse, are you going to comment on this? Because we already have Alex's analysis here. What about you?
Alex, I just have one question for you.
Yes, sir.
What's your opinion of Quacks of Quedlinburg?
Ooh. So, Quacks of Quedlinburg is a game that initially when I first played it, I decided it wasn't like a game that I didn't see the hype and buzz and why people liked it so much. And I actually moved on from it. But it's one of the games that I decided to get back and give a second chance. And I have really enjoyed the whimsical nature of the game. I think it's a very specific type of game. And it's certainly not one that I think you'll win for strategy alone. There's a healthy amount of luck and how the odds end up favoring your bag building and what pulls out and in what order. But all that said, I actually really enjoy Quacks of Quedlinburg.
Okay, because that's all Cubitos is.
which means that two of you are getting rid of it, but it's still an amazing game, and I will happily get my own.
Okay, so, first of all, Jesse's completely, he's not 100% wrong on this, because I included it in my description, but he is wrong.
I'm like 90%
no,
right,
Jesse.
Dan.
Okay, first of all, I am so far keeping Kubitos. And based on some research that I've done on the game, some concerns were brought up to me that I hadn't considered before, but I actually very much agree with, based on a review that Space Biff did, where he pretty much criticized the lack of play interaction in a racing game of this style, that after a little bit more reflection, I do 100% agree with. So, the conversation that popped up after our gameplay,
interesting,
Alex,
Jen, because that was one of the elements that I criticized when we were discussing, and you roundabout rejected my critique.
The reason why I rejected that is because I thought that the other modules within the game would allow
The reason you rejected it is, remember, Jesse, remember how when I met you, or not when I met you, when you dropped by here, one of my friends met you and was like, oh my gosh, a celebrity, a YouTube celebrity. And I'm like, I am like 2,000 subscribers behind this guy. Why are you so impressed with him? It's because people we know are just not impressive or worthy of listening to, Jen. Isn't
Look,
that right?
The reason why I said that, the actual reason was, is because I had understood based on the game of the rule book that the other modules would allow more player interaction and a little bit more pushing, a little bit more things. But after Space Biff's review, it was clarified to me that that doesn't happen later on, which was a little
I'm
bit of a
glad someone else could clarify that point.
Well,
that
Space
I already
Biff
made.
Is a man worth listening to.
Well, Space Biff, I'm 100% sure, played it at a minimum 5 games
and
before he made his review.
And picked up on the exact same points that I made, apparently. So, I mean...
Oh, so in other words, 1 second. So, in other words, Jesse can figure this out after one play. He's 5 times faster than Space Biff. 5 times
no,
more worth listening
that's
to.
That's not how that works. Either way, what Jesse's main critique was is that he felt that this was exactly Quacks of Quedlinburg. Well, I completely disagree with him.
I didn't say...
That sure, there are... pieces of this.
Jan, I didn't say exactly like Quacks of Quedlinburg. I think the shared board is different.
God. Okay. So here's the main differences between Quacks of Quedlinburg and this game. Positional placement, you're able to kind of control where you're going and how you're doing things, going to the left, going to the right, going upwards, just rushing to the end of the goal, all has direct and immediate results as to what's happening. The other area where this is really interesting is that I disagree that the same bag building element and control that's in Quacks of Quedlinburg is the same here. You have a little bit more control as to how you're pushing.
You're drawing up special powers that represent various colors. You're pushing your luck either by rolling dice or drawing from a bag. Each of those luck-based mm-hmm. mechanisms has a bust ability, and they directly tie to how far you're pushing up a track and what abilities or extra resources that you're scoring.
Because it's dice rolling, you have a little bit more control over what's happening. It's a lot more perceptual. You know how to push. You know when to do it. You know what you can do when you can do it.
I mean... In the bag, you have a good sense of how many white potential berries that you have left. You know what you've structured your bag full of. You have a sequencing of abilities.
Sure, sure. I hear you. And you're right. You're 100% right. But what you're forgetting is that in this game, because all the dice faces are shown to you when you pick up a power, you know the probability of what that dice can roll. So it just gives you an additional incentive, and it allows for more decision space whenever you decide to push versus Quack, when it's literally mostly just blind drawing, depending on the probability of you drawing that one chip. At least here, you know that 6 sides of the dice, what it could end up being if you decide to keep moving forward. One of the most interesting things about this game is that it is more of a deck builder or a deck. It basically has limitations. You have an amount of dice that you can roll at any given time. You have 9, and depending on the types of rolls that you do and the types of blank faces that you leave in the board, you're going to have less dice that you're going to be able to bring on your next roll. So you have to be very careful, and you have to know when you have to purge some elements so that you can always have the most effective dice available to you at any given time. Ultimately,
I do know how we can settle this. Just ask Space Biff.
Oh my God. At the end of the day, Kubitos is a really fun game. I think it is hampered a little bit by not falling into the zaniness of the race, which I think would have helped create that more differentiation, at least for Jesse. Being able to push someone and being able to affect the water and being able to like slow down or leave a trap behind or something more a la Mario Kart, I do think, based on what I've read and what I've experienced so far out of my two gameplays, would have probably helped a little bit. So I'm hoping in the future for a little expansion that comes in and refreshes the game a little bit more. But so far, it has been fairly enjoyable, and it is very, very frantic, which also is, I would say, is a little bit different from Quacks of Quedlinburg, because you have that feeling of tension more so because of the race nature of it.
I don't agree. All that being said, Alex, have you ever been interested in being a 2-mile-tall, overpowered cosmic frog able to harvest
if you're talking about cosmic frog, then the answer is no, because that theme for that game has been so bizarre to me that I actually haven't picked it up, just because I'm still not sure what to make of it.
You wrote this one off because of the theme?
Well, because, I mean, unlike yourself, Jesse, the idea of a bizarre story like this isn't capturing my imagination. It's making me wonder what kind of game it is.
I picked this one up specifically because of the theme, without any context for what the game is at all.
So what is the game? Because I genuinely have not bothered looking into this because the theme has been bizarre.
Interesting. So Cosmic Frog is going to be a sort of set collection, combat, and territory control game in a arbitrary way. You're going to have various asymmetrically powered cosmic entities that are going to be moving across two different regions of a board. One board has a variety of different resources and shards on it, the split broken parts of terrain and planets that you're going to be swallowing into your gullet. You're then going to be jumping out into the ether, where you can regurgitate those into your own little habitual zone, into a lockbox that you have. And at the end of the game, you're going to score based off of how effectively you've gathered, collected, and organized your own little subterranean collection or sort of your own little habitat. But that's not where the core element or charm of this game comes in. This is a head-to-head, punch each other or kick each other in the face, throat, and neck, break through different barriers of rock and shards and earth, thrust someone out into the ether, punch them so hard that they regurgitate the different shards in different environments that they're holding in their gold, and you're able to re-swallow them in response. This is very much a head-to-head battle game on a cosmic scale that works with a lot of, I'd say, Euro-esque principles as it approaches the way that you play the game.
I don't know if I'm more interested or less interested. Mechanically, the game sounds intriguing, but thematically, I am even more off-put than I was before.
Wait,
but this is not
why are
this
you
show,
off-put
this show
by
is
the
not
idea of,
me.
Of giant deities swallowing various earthen terrain and regurgitating
it's
them
it's
into the lockbox?
Regurgitation of said earthen terrain and knocking people in each other's stomach.
They're just holding it into
it's,
their gullet, not their stomach. If they put it in their stomach, it would completely dissolve into the ether because they have so much acidic power built up inside of them.
So I think you're keeping this one. I don't even know what you feel about the gameplay, but the theme is so absolutely bizarrely unique that I don't really see you getting rid of this one just on that merit alone.
I actually know what he's doing because we played this one together with, I think it was, we played it with five people, which is a really high player count for this type of game. And I know exactly how Jesse feels about it. So I don't think I'm going to say, Jesse, go ahead.
I mean, this game was absolutely lovely and brilliant and wonderful in a variety of different ways and reasons. It encourages head-to-head combat games. It doesn't have too many penalties associated with that combat system, but it really does reward being in each other's face and engaging. I think five players was a perfect amount to play this game at. I think it functioned effectively and quickly, was fairly easy to learn and teach while still having a very, very captivating puzzle with how you're placing down your terrain in your own little board in a way that, you know, depending on how you choose to score, your score and math can end up in a variety of different ways. This game is mean. This game is unapologetically mean, meaning that if you're playing with friends who don't like to have their resources stripped from them, have their stomach or throat punched so that they regurgitate all of the potential scoring things that they have already swallowed and watch you slowly devour them and then put them in your own scoring system, you might not enjoy this game. But for me, I was very, very charmed and absolutely enjoyed my experience with Cosmic Frog.
Excellent. I'm curious how you felt, Jen.
Yeah, actually, so I thought that this game was very swingy in a lot of ways. I thought that the combat mechanic was not necessarily my favorite. I felt that the way that the turn structure goes was completely maddening. Basically, there's a deck of cards that has four cards for each player that's shuffled, and a player could go four times in a row, or they could go one at the beginning of the game, then wait for 20 to 25 minutes until everybody else goes.
Oh, no, not 20 to 25 minutes. You're ridiculous.
And then go at the very end of that and just do three actions. The way that things are scored is a little bit complex.
I thought the turn
and,
order
and
system
strange.
Was really, really nice, Jen.
The rule book was made in a way that made a game that is essentially very, very simple feel cosmically larger than it actually was, which I was baffled that we spent over an hour. We spent over an hour going over this game that we could have, if the rulebook was explained correctly and everything, we could have potentially got into the table in less than 20 minutes because it was honestly that simple. And so I don't know. There's a lot of mechanics and little niches here and there that maybe not sure if I wanted to keep this one. I 100% agree with Jesse in the sense that you have to love Take That games because this is Take That to the 10th degree.
It's combat. Like, it's combat less than
no,
Take That.
No, it is not combat. It is Take That because I literally took every single opportunity you had to score in this game, I took away from
you. Sure, but
and then
take,
after that,
take that's a very,
somebody took it away from
take
me.
Take That's a very specific mechanic.
This is Take That. Why is it Take That? Because let's say, Jesse, that you have accumulated around 30 victory points that you could make potentially for the end of the game. If people target you, and they will,
yes,
they will take your 30 victory points away from you and leave you with zero.
Take That implies a degree or lack of control or agency over the situation that's happening. Whereas in Cosmic Frog, you have a significant amount of control when it comes to where you're located, how you manipulate your dice, whether or not you hold on to or reveal your secret power or secret ability, and how you position yourself based off of the abilities that you have.
I understand what you're saying, but at the end of the day, you're being a little bit too lenient with the term Take That. I can assure you that a lot of people would hear what we just described and consider that Take That, regardless of how much control there is about it. Basically, if you can take things from others, it is considered Take That, regardless of how much mitigation or protections that you can erect to protect yourself from the Take That. There is still Take That in this game. And for me, I understand the conceit of it. I just didn't necessarily love it. We did play the game a little bit differently than what is advertised or how you should. We weren't as combat focus at the beginning of this, and we allowed kind of like a runaway leader issue here. Very similar to Root. You know, in Root, you have factions, and if all the factions aren't working together to bring each other down, somebody's going to take it away. Same thing happens right here. One of our players started collecting from the very beginning of the game these islands, and nobody contested against him. I had a personal vendetta with Jesse. I was trying to make him feel what I felt in the Hall of the Mountain King, and I kicked him into the fifth dimension of this game, and he never got and he didn't get out until the end of the game when it was too late, and then that other player won. But the other people didn't do anything. So all in all, Alex, I'm very mixed about this one. Very, very mixed.
It doesn't sound like you're mixed, Jan.
It sounds like I hate it, doesn't it?
But it sounds like you hate it.
I don't know because the game itself is really intriguing. It's fascinating the way that you're collecting tiles, the idea that this is a skirmish game where there's also pattern building and there's a little bit of puzzle building as well, being able to go across this board and having all this terrain to go through. It is fascinating, but I don't know. I think you're right. I don't think it's right for me.
I think the most accurate thing that I've heard in that entire conversation was, I have a vendetta against Jesse.
Settle down. It's time for our Medley Minute, a moment of respite before the rest of our show.
Well, after that intro segment, Jan, if anyone's ready for a rest, I think I am. And luckily enough for you, I'm bringing in a solo game called Maquis. Maquis is going to be a lovely little solo worker placement puzzle, which is currently available on Kickstarter.
Wait, this is currently available on Kickstarter, isn't it?
I was getting there. It is currently available.
But this is the wrong section, Jesse.
Alex,
this is the Medley Minute.
Alex, I'm bringing in...
I try to tell him. He just doesn't want to listen.
All right, listen. Maquis, This is the second printing with a little bit of expanded content, but this is a game that's already out, has already been available, has already been in my collection. I don't want to bring it in as something that I'm telling people to go pay attention to or back. I mean, it is on Kickstarter. That's the reason I'm bringing it up, but it is just all around a lovely little solo experience. And I think if people enjoy solitary worker placement strategy games, they should be paying attention to this one.
And I remember that you really enjoyed it, Jesse. What particularly did you enjoy about Maquis when you tried it that first time?
Again, it's just that solo-oriented worker placement system. You're very much focused on the unique little variable puzzle that you've been given on this same, standard board, where you're doing your very best to move around the city, collect resources, establish safe havens or bunkers, produce whatever resources and items that you need, and complete whatever puzzle or objective you've been given. It has a interesting way of scaling with the different types of challenges that you can be presented with. It has a ton of lovely art and theme, and really is, just like the heart of a worker placement game, a worker placement game that functions, operates, and works very, very well. I mean, this is a solo Euro experience that is contained in a small box package, plays with about 20 to 30 minutes, and genuinely gives me everything I'm looking for a quick playing solo experience.
And is the new edition including anything? Anything new? Anything different? A new
there
scenario?
There is a little bit of different content. There is a upgrade pack that you can get, but mostly this is going to be the second edition and the reprint. And at $29 for a back, this one is not a bad deal.
Yeah, I mean, it looks intriguing, and the solo game aspect of it does pull me in general. I like small, accessible solo games. The most confusing thing is really just what it's doing in the medley minute.
It's here because
that is a mystery we'll never be able to solve.
Well, we all needed a break, and I thought a solo game would be a good suggestion.
Well, so speaking of small, easily accessible packages, my medley minute's going to be Monster Hunter World, the board game, which is going to be gigantic, over-the-top miniatures, including one that's going to be a 350-millimeter dragon.
You're talking, Primal is currently on Kickstarter.
Not anymore.
Actually, Primal just ended.
Oh. Yep.
And Monster Hunter World managed to release all of the information about their game and their pledges right before it ended.
You're saying they're not the same?
They're not exactly the same, although it would be easily to confuse the two, because both of them are going to be heavy boss battlers against a variety of creatures that somehow managed to mostly be lizard-like dragons. Both of them are going to have a whole bunch of heroes and rely heavily on card play. Both of them are going to have nothing to do with an actual, like, you know, narrative story, but more of a hunt, kill, craft, rinse, repeat until
awesome,
you get
like
to the
Monster
end of the adventure.
Hunter.
Like Monster Hunter, like Primal, the two of them are surprisingly similar, and yet with Steamforge releasing all the information about Monster Hunter World, well, that's why I'm talking about it.
So, okay, if you can give me a straight up, very to the point differentiation between Primal and this new game, what is it exactly?
Oh, well, you're asking me to condense a good 20 minutes of differences into 30 seconds, but let me see what I can do. Primal is going to be a game that has already hit reviewers' hands and therefore is going to be a little bit more validated with having a bunch of opinions, so that's going to be a win there. Primal comes with more monsters, at least as of now, before we get into stretch goals, because stretch goals will be, I guess we'll figure it out in April when this campaign launches. Monster Hunter is going to come with more heroes. The prices are going to be roughly comparable, although Monster Hunter does give you a cheaper pledge in terms of if you just want to start off with just jumping into the game. There is going to be a $70 pledge option, which is much cheaper, comes with far less content, but if you wanted that lower barrier to entry, Monster Hunter will have that. Gameplay wise, we don't know enough about the full gameplay. Both of them are going to be heavily relying on card play, although Monster Hunter does seem to have more of a card play where you play a bunch of cards down to a sequence before resolving that sequence, more of a, like, you line them up and then dish them out all at once, which is going to be a little similar to the way Primal hands it, but still slightly different. And then the board is going to be the most obvious difference that we know right now, with Primal just having that little four-way turning around in a circle board, versus Monster Hunter World is actually going to give you a tactical grid to navigate on around mm-hmm. the monsters.
Okay, interesting. And this is by Steamforged as well, right?
This is by Steamforged Games.
I'm curious how it'll turn out at the end, for sure. Gonna keep an eye on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Steamforged Games is a game that is a company that I constantly keep an eye on, because on the one hand, the things they produce are always interesting and like I want to pay attention to. On the other hand, Steamforged Games does have a mixed record when it comes to dealing with IPs and how well they are received. So like I certainly hope that if one of them is going to break the mold, I want it to be this one because I am tempted, but we'll see. I'm definitely keeping an eye on it.
Do you have space for two monster battlers, Alex?
I think so. Primal is actually surprisingly accessible when you compare it to many other games in my collection. I'd rather get rid of Gloomhaven in a heartbeat to make room for a second boss battler like this, just in terms of the way I'll pull them out and play them.
That's the second time that we've disparaged the poor name of Gloomhaven on this podcast.
I think Gloomhaven's great. I just think sometimes accessibility is going to be, at the end of the day, a factor. And Primal, even though it's technically a campaign game, at coming in at, you know, an hour-long missions through 11 to 15 missions means I can knock out a game of it in 2 to 3 weeks. It means it's more accessible. And if Monster Hunter World repeats that, then that's cool with me. I like accessibility. I like being able to just jump into it. Gloomhaven, I mean, the sheer amount of time and effort you have to spend getting Gloomhaven to the table. Jaws of the Lion is going to be a different story, obviously, but it's not a lack of respect for Gloomhaven. It's just the con of the flip side of how good it otherwise is.
Well, I will be very tempted to not get that Brachiadios miniature. It has to be there. But with that, I have some pretty gigantic news, almost the same as the monsters in Monster Hunter. Leader Games just put out a announcement today on social media that there's a new expansion for Root called the Marauders Expansion, and they actually already uploaded a little snippet of what we can expect on BGG.
So the news has been available for a while at this point. The Kickstarter page, the Save This, like, Kickstarter so that you back it, is what was updated today.
I had no idea that the Marauders expansion came out, actually.
So anyone that was following along behind the scenes had already been made aware about a month ago that the Badgers and Rats and also the modular rules or minor factions were going to be introduced. But the big news of today, Jan, is that the official Save the Date Kickstarter page is up.
February 23rd for the new expansion. So the Badgers and the Mice, I'm not sure who's who, but one is called the Warlord and the others are called the Stone Seekers. And there's a little bit of copy here because I had no idea that this was coming out at all. So I'm assuming that there has to be other players that are fans of Root, but probably not just diehard fans.
And one of the reasons I'm aware of this, Jan, is because we just got done recording a full interview. I just got done recording a full interview with Cole Worley, which will be posted here on the Patreon page sometime over the next week or two, that dives into some of the other projects he's working on, but even more specifically, this expansion for Root.
Yeah, and we're also hoping to bring that to the actual podcast, probably in place of Plated One. So we'll see how that goes. But a little bit more information on this one. The Warlord is both charismatic and terrifying. He rules over a vast horde of warriors recently arrived to the woodland and is interested only in its domination. To help speed his conquest, he lights massive fires which can spread throughout the woods and destroy the buildings of other factions. The Stone Seekers are strangers to the woodland, here only to recover the scattered and lost relics of an ancient civilization. The Seekers work to establish way stations across the woodland and form alliances with other factions in hopes of recovering the relics more quickly. Both of these factions are going to be suitable for Root's two-player game, bringing the total number of two-player factions up to 5 without the use of bots. And also in the Marauders expansion, they're going to introduce a new level of conflict, which is what you mentioned, Jesse, minor factions. And these are small factions that can be used at any player count and introduce surprising new power combinations as well as chess-like tension to lower player count games of Root. So it sounds like overall this is just trying to bridge the gap of all player counts, just trying to make every game more interesting but without as much upkeep with those automata factions, which I think is very merited. It sounds really exciting, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I've really been enjoying Root the more I play it, despite all the critiques I technically have of the game. I still find it a lot of fun to play. And as a result, I'm definitely interested in any new factions and especially shifts to two-player gameplay that make the game more accessible.
I will say, Leader, if you're listening, please give us a bigger box. I can't fit all of it already on the core box.
They've already confirmed big box, not really on their radar.
No! Oh! Okay, I'm going to reel back from this. And let's just
get into on the radar before my heart breaks that a big box is never coming for Root. Today, I'm bringing in a game by the name of Reload. Reload is a game by Colossal Games that just came onto Kickstarter, I believe, today, and it has a really interesting premise. Basically, Reload is the distillation of your Battle Royale games into a board game. The way that it's going to work is that you're going to have a modular map that you're going to build, and you're basically superstars. You're being influenced by different mega corporations, and they're all striving to make you the most famous in this huge out-of-world show. And the way that you do that is that you start gaining fame as the game goes along, and that's actually one of the more unique elements of Reload. But ultimately, this is a dice placement game. You're rolling dice and using those dice to allocate certain actions being either moving on the board, creating barriers to protect yourself from oncoming fire, searching the board for new weapons, and pretty much just moving forward those achievement tracks to see if you can be named the superstar of Reload. And based around that main name, Reload is the way that you force your opponents to kind of respawn on the map, and is the way that you gain the most victory points out of this. All in all, I just came aware of this today. Alex, I think you were the one that brought this to my attention, and it looks pretty interesting so far, and at a really accessible price point as well.
Yeah, the interesting thing that I'm seeing, Jan, that Alex has also brought to my attention and taught me to do is pay attention to the wording and structure of reviews. And we have Jamie Stegmeier saying, I absolutely love the visual of the frame tracks. We have Scott Alden saying one of the most action-packed games ever. It's the first board game that really captures the feel of a Battle Royale style video game. We have Jeremy Holmes saying Reload promises a fast-paced romp anchored by an innovative combat mechanic. We have Michael Knight saying, when I first heard about Reload, I was a bit skeptical. However, after playing it and delving into the rules, I can honestly say I love this game.
And there's one more. There's one more here. It says, Reload surprisingly manages to deliver on the feel of a Battle Royale experience. I can't wait to see the final game by Alex Randolph.
With the note of pay attention to the wording, the structure, the way that quotes are approached, we have one or two quotes that specifically say this is doing something unique. The one that I was paying the most attention to is honestly going to be from Scott Alden from BGG, which says
that was a pretty good one,
which says that it really replicates or gives you that feel of a Battle Royale style game, which for me is intriguing because that is a genre that I haven't seen adapted very effectively yet. However, the one from Alex Randolph is very, very middle of the road.
It's intended to be middle of the road. Reload is a game that I had an opportunity to play a single time online. And I did, while I genuinely meant every word I said there, that it manages to deliver on the feel of Battle Royale experience, and I can't wait to see the final game. It's exactly the fact that I don't feel I have a full picture of the game. I'm intrigued. I'm backing the game. I would like to see the final product, but I also didn't have enough of an opportunity to play with it to say something certain, like, I love this game. This game is a must back. I must have this in my collection. I enjoyed my time with it. It's roughly a 40 minute long experience, quick and easy to jump into, accessible. It has fun. It has powers and abilities. It has an interesting dice mitigation system that's going to be the way you both utilize your actions as well as your defense that you build up. And I wasn't sure how I felt about that. That part felt a little bit fiddly, a little bit innovative. I'm not entirely sure how it ultimately plays out. I do like the cards and the closing down of the map. So Reload is a game that I think is worth paying attention to, especially for the playtime and the price point. But it is going to take more plays before I'm willing to say with confidence, I love this game and you should absolutely get it.
And Alex, I have a very important question because this is, and maybe my comparison is completely wrong. Have you played Adrenaline? And if you have, is this similar to that in any way?
I have played Adrenaline only once, but I will say my one play of Adrenaline made me not interested in playing it again, and my one play of Reload has me very interested in playing it again.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of Adrenaline either. I know why people enjoy the concept of the game, but for me, it didn't execute on what I was looking for. And if Reload's able to, with that Battle Royale style, I'm intrigued. I mean, I have room in my collection for a game that does that, and I haven't found one that does it well yet.
Well, there's special player powers. Like, as Alex said, maybe the dice mitigation, the dice control and dice mechanics aren't 100% full-fledged, but it adds a lot more decision space than probably Adrenaline did. You have a lot of variability with the way that you're collecting things. There's three different tiers of loot that you can gather in this game as well. And Alex, what about that fame track? That's kind of like the number one thing that they're promoting.
The fame track I really loved. I really enjoyed it, mm-hmm. and for a variety of reasons. First of all, the variability of the various things you can do in the game to ultimately win, because in the game, that fame track is going to result in many of the actions you take in the game are going to reward you with varying amounts of fame for the things you're doing. And things like damaging other players, killing other players, delivering certain goods, all these things will and accomplishing certain objectives on the board, they're all going to result in elements of fame being added to your track. And one of the things I love is you get fame both for damaging and for the final blow. I do not like game design that involves one player taking all the glory by knocking mm-hmm. out the final blow, and this game does manage to mitigate that by giving you both.
Yeah, honestly, like, I look at this and I just think, like, this is the ultimate version of Adrenaline. That's where my mind goes every single time that I open up this page and I see what's happening. And I'm very pumped about it. I think I may even back this one at the full Superstar Pledge. Not sure if this is a game that you would play at two players, but hey, it's more characters and more variability, so why not?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm intrigued by the game. I met my quote. I think it's worth checking out. I want to see how it plays out. I want to get my hands on a copy of the game, and I want to see whether that 40-minute playtime combined with what the game does well, whether it's enough to be an interesting and permanent addition to my collection, or whether it's just a good game, that's worth moving on from.
Yeah, I will say that the only thing that I was a little bit disappointed by the Kickstarter is that there's not a page that specifically explains the turn by turn or the actual mechanics. It's all done through smaller videos. I would have liked to just be able to read through it a little bit, but either way, very excited for this one.
Yeah. And so for me, this week, I'm going to be bringing in CoraQuest. CoraQuest, mm-hmm. a game designed by Dan and Cora Hughes back in lockdown. Effectively, once they were doing homeschool, they said, hey, let's design a board game, because that's what all of us do when we're stuck at home. And so Dan and Cora sat there and put together a dungeon crawler that is meant for the whole family, a dungeon crawler that is accessible, easy to teach, easy to play, but with enough depth of the actual experience that it's not, you know, some shoddy knockoff, but rather something that's genuinely fun and entertaining to play. And what I will say before even getting to the Kickstarter itself, before even covering all that, I will say, having played it both with my kids as well as with a very energetic and slightly hyped up adult Quackalope, it is a game that actually genuinely delivers on the promise. It is a game that is appealing. The art is gorgeous, because the art is done by kids but then dressed up by the artist, by Gary. It's dressed up in order to be, well, a consistent theme across the whole game, and it really does capture that. It manages to be a game that is drawn by children and yet actually kind of works at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the core actions and systems in the game are simple enough to teach, to engage in, that it really is a dungeon crawler that is accessible. It's a dungeon crawler that is fun, simple, easy to play, allows enough room for you to make strategically poor decisions, as children are wont to do at times, while being challenging enough that it's not a complete free-for-all where you can do whatever you want. CoraQuest launched on Kickstarter today, and it's currently at 1,800 backers already, doing phenomenally well for effectively a homegrown project by a father and daughter stuck at home just designing a board game. And I'm incredibly excited for them, and anyone who's looking for a dungeon crawler for your kids, for your family, or just a gateway light experience, you should check out CoraQuest.
Which is honestly not a genre that I would have ever expected to be for kids, so that's fantastic.
I mean,
and it looks so adorable.
Again, just hitting on the point of reading the quotes that are put on a page. There's one here that says, CoraQuest makes me proud to be part of this community. It's the best introduction to a dungeon crawl I have played.
That's a
pretty solid, certain testimonial.
It is. It's a very confident testimonial.
Yeah, it's you. I knew it was you. That sounded like you.
Yeah, it is. This game's absolutely lovely. And here's the thing. The most criticism I have seen from this game, from the community, from the fans, and even from myself, is losing people on the artwork. It is a game that has artwork that is drawn by children and then illustrated and colorized by Gary. It's been Garified. And I got to admit, the artwork did not sell me on this game initially either. When I first got the email, I wasn't sold on covering it. Artwork and flavor text is one of the very first things that I check. Then I check social media pages, and then I start digging into the rules and mechanics if a game survives through all of that. Luckily for me, this game, when it came to the way that that Dan and his daughter were interacting with the community, were investing in building a space, there was something special going on here. And so I was just thrilled and genuinely proud that I got to be a part of this and cover it and show it off and share it with my community. And here's what I'll say. I understand the concern around the artwork from gamers that are like myself, that don't have children, that don't have a family they're planning on playing this with, that, you know, genuinely still couldn't draw as good of these pictures as have been produced, but still, for some reason, have my nose stuck up in the air when it comes to the way that art and design is illustrated. This game really, really, really ends up being something special on the table. The artwork didn't sell me until I started playing it, and now I'm absolutely charmed by it. I, again, stand by that idea. If you want an introductory dungeon crawl, if you want a family-based dungeon crawl, if you want something that can bring people into this space, who are open to a more whimsical, more adventure-based, more, sort of, you know, Cartoon Network-style, adventure, this one does it, and it does it in spades, and it's a responsible game. It's produced and designed and refined really, really well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Core Quest is interesting. It wasn't on my radar until one day it was. I was following along with their creation on Board Game Breakfast on the Dice Tower, where Dan Hughes talked about the whole process. And I remember just hearing about it here and there and thinking, oh, that's sweet. Dad and daughter creating a board game. I have no interest.
Yeah, yeah.
And it really developed. It really genuinely developed from something that I wrote off as a excellent father-daughter adventure, but not one that I was going to be a part of, to the fact that now I am a part of it. And I'm excited. Oh, fun fact. When I say I'm a part of it, spoiler.
I know.
I'm genuinely a part of it.
Well,
Ricky and I will be writing
Wes,
a quest. If stretch goals get hit,
yeah.
Then Ricky and I will be writing a quest together for this game.
Ricky, if we're going to be honest.
Well, absolutely. She has already picked out the main characters. I'm helping her just structure it into the storyline.
Yeah, you're there for punctuation and grammar, which, let's be honest, in a few years, she won't even need you for that.
Yep, 100% agreed, and I couldn't be happier with it. The idea of being able to be a part of this experience, or more specifically, make my daughter be a part of this experience, it's like, again, I went from writing it off as cute little thing to being genuinely honored to be a part of Core Quest.
Yeah, see, I submitted artwork too, hoping that I'd be included, and they emphasized they needed something that was a little bit more refined in design. you know, I tried, though. At least I tried.
Well, I don't have kids, so I'm not sure who I would play this with, but I can tell that this will be such a fantastic and memorable experience.
Jen, you'd play it with me. You'd play it with Alex, because here's what we've challenged the community on the video that we put out. If this game is open-ended in the way that you can modularly design, you can create your own custom characters very easily based off of a web-based app that they have that fully integrate and like design into the game space that work mechanically and functionally, and everything in this game is designed for you to be able to craft your own little play experience, just like Alex is talking about. And so what we've told the community is, if they want us to play through and feature and dive back into this title, which I'd be perfectly happy to do so, all they should do is take a little bit of time to design us a hardcore mode, and then we'll have an adventure that is unlike the children-based, family-friendly version of Core Quest.
It's awesome that it has that level of flexibility. It almost feels
it's like
open source board game. That's awesome. And yes, Jesse, like a cherry pie too.
Talking about open source, talking about something interesting happening in the hobby, which, and I'm going to cut to the chase here. Alex and Jan both have snubbed their noses in the direction of what I'm bringing in. So before you all even bring it up, I'm going to admit that neither of you have very high quality or refined taste. We're going to be talking about RPGs. We're going to be talking about indie zines. We're going to be talking about one of the largest Kickstarter and tabletop RPG events that happens throughout the course of the year. And I do want to shout out Plus One XP, which is a YouTube channel that I follow that produces really great indie RPG content. They're a new channel just starting up, and they're the ones that tuned me on to this project that happens. It's 3 years running now, called Zine Quest. Zine Quest is going to be a giant publishing collection, an adventure of hundreds of different little mini RPG titles coming to Kickstarter all across the same month. Across the next 30 days, we're going to have somewhere around 300 to 350 projects launch. These are going to be little staple-based magazine-style RPG, either supplements, one-shots, individual quests, world-building, or journaling adventure projects. All of these have their own twist, flavor, artwork, and way that you utilize them in the game experience. But the incredible thing about this project is not only the coalition of self-published indie titles, projects that have been worked on lovingly through the course of the last year or so, but also the fact that about 90% of these projects will successfully fund over the course of this expanse, partially due to it being a smaller threshold, being able to print a $12 to $20 little PDF or zine book is a lot more accessible for people to back, but also the price point on it doesn't have to be as high as some of these other board game or RPG games that come to the platform. But the idea of 300, 350 individual projects, most of which will be successful and all of which have some degree of a interested fan base that is actively growing and participating, I'm super charmed by this. And I even want to be a part of this project next year. I would love to bring our first, you know, test run at a Kickstarter to be a little zine, to be a little zine RPG book or supplement guide or something along those lines. It's such an interesting way as a creator to get into the publishing space, to experiment with a low risk, low funding goal Kickstarter project and learn so much across the board. The reality is the RPG world is bigger than the board game world when it comes to social media followings, even profitability in a lot of areas. And so this may be a growing space we should all be paying attention to.
You know what, Jesse? I totally agree with you. RPGs are so big that they should have their own category in Kickstarter, so I don't have to go through these when I'm going through our board game Kickstarters, because it drives me mad every single year.
They're also organized in a thing where, so if you swing over to Kickstarter, you can literally click on a tab on the front page called Zine Quest, and that will bring you to an organized collection of all of these projects that have come to the platform.
And if you're trying to look for board games, well, I'm sorry, it's going to be littered with zines across everything.
If it's board game news on Kickstarter you're looking for, I recommend subscribing to Board Game Co. on YouTube, and he's got your back.
All right. All that being said, let's go over very quickly a few of the projects that I myself am personally backing and that I think people who love RPGs should be taking a look at. We have a project called All Must Bow by Bleak Horizons Press. Reality is a rotting fruit, and the tiny creature that crawls across its surface is doomed. The dreadful ancient things that lurk beneath its skin have one demand in return for living beings' continued existence: obedience. Across all worlds, all spaces, all must bow. In this game, you're going to be playing the role of the warlord, of the person who is controlling, the chaos, the evil that humans and other creatures are going up against and facing. This is a RPG setting designed not from the perspective of a triumphant investigator or helpless stumbler, but from the view of the villain. Alongside that, we also have another one called Torque. Torque is by Will Jobist. And this is going to be a little indie RPG post-apocalyptic get in your car and drive across the country adventure or zine. You're a driver, licensed to go anywhere, and with the grit to handle anything. There's gas in the tank and an X on the map, the miles of blacktop ahead. Let's hit the road. So this is going to be the rules system for a little 2-5 player single session or multi-session campaign where you are a traveler with special talents who venture from community to community to help in any way they can. Touchstones of Mad Max, Death Standing, and Redline. Next is going to be Into the Vast Dark, a zine about exploring dark and alien megastructures of an infinite realm. This is going to be by Charles Ferguson Avery. And I've got a little bit of flavor text here. And both of you look so bored, but I don't care. I'm driving forward. Seek the empty, the broken, the dilapidated. It is closer than you think. Search for the uncanny, the hidden, and wrong. They are unsettling to you. Observe the spot with your eyes, your hands, your breath. Let it inside you. Whisper so that only you may hear. I wish to see the vast in the dark and fall backwards without fear. You are already there. The Vast in the Dark is an exploration setting of the world's most popular role-playing game and takes place in a crumbling alien wasteland filled with a brutalist megastructure ruins. It includes tools for generating massive areas to explore, as well as unique player options and gameplay changes to keep the focus on player choices and ingenuity over dice rolling and chance. And then finally, the last one, I promise, but I love what these projects are doing, is going to be a project called Brutal Quest, a narrative miniature rule from Nick Evans. Brutal Quest is a set of simple narrative skirmish rules designed for playing quick and violent miniature battles in a world of vicious fantasy. So if you want a system to set up the most gruesome and aggressive, one-shot battle sequences, this is going to be your grab and go.
And Jesse, I actually have one more to add here. It's from last year, but it was done by our friend Camilla McGregor.
Oh,
she was participant of zine of the zine thing.
I think she I think she might have a project launching this year as well, which I do plan to highlight and talk about. We've been texting, and she hasn't told me what it is. Darn it, I wish I knew. Camilla, she is who introduced me at Labyrinth Games and Puzzles to the entire world of D&D, of RPGs, of board gaming as a whole. So you have her to thank for a lot of where I am.
So the one that she made last year, the one that she helped, that she collaborated with, because it wasn't just her, was called The Demon Collective Volume 1, and that was published by GMDK, a tabletop role-playing game publisher devoted to the idea that RPGs are for everyone. So in this whole zine that you're doing, if you want to keep supporting more people and you have a few extra dollars in there, if you look for The Demon Collective Volume 1, I'm hoping that maybe you can get a copy of this one and support Camilla, that she did an amazing job, and the artwork in this one is absolutely stunning as well.
Yeah, I'm just super excited about this world of little zines that I didn't understand last year, even though I saw them appear and approach. I think a lot of people don't quite know what's going on, especially in the board game space, because as Jen said, they do sort of mix and mingle to a degree. And so I think it is worth, even if you're not an RPG fan, I think it is valuable to have some knowledge of what's going on here. And if you are a fan of Kickstarter as a platform, if you're a fan of indie content creators, and if you love RPGs, this is really like the Super Bowl event of the year. You should be paying attention to what's happening here, because the stars of the next era of RPG writing are probably experimenting with what they're going to produce down the road during this month, during this cycle of a publishing frenzy. And Alex, I know you've been silent this entire time because
Alex still here?
He doesn't like story, flavor text, artwork, fun, doesn't like anything.
RPGs in general as a category I haven't really had that much opportunity with them, but they just haven't pulled me in that much. I'm happy to have my mind changed, but I mean, the combination of indie, and which is something you love, and RPG and story is something you love. They're things I respect the process. I respect their existence, and I'm happy they are in this space. But as far as my ability to contribute in a meaningful way, I wish I could, but I just don't have that just yet.
My contribution is just that recommendation. Create a separate RPG category, and everybody will be happy.
Get out of here.
Board gamers will be happy. RPGers will be happy.
I've about had enough of your...
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.
So for everyone that stayed after the credits, thank you so very much. This is our audience feedback section that is completely fueled by you. We have a website, theweeklyquack.com, and we also have a Facebook page where we are always looking for your questions, for your ideas, and for what you want us to cover in the future. So please, if you haven't visited yet, make sure to stop by really quick, leave a quick comment, and we will be sure to include it in next week's episode. But with that said, we do have some new faces and some new people that are commenting on the Weekly Quack that we brought in today. And I'm going to start with Carl R. Carl R. says, rule books are a barrier to games. Teaching overcomes that. Shut Up and Sit Down has a great video about teaching. I'm curious about what you guys would add to this discussion. Any tips, your style of teaching, etc.
Yeah, I've avoided the Shut Up and Sit Down video because I remember when it came out, Jan and my entire game group went head over heels about this video. Jan is someone who specifically has studied teaching over the last year to try to become as good and proficient at it as possible, because our game
still working at it.
Our game group emphasize that when we first included him in the circle, he might not have been the most proficient or skilled.
Maybe that was you.
As far as, well, me and Matt and William and no, but either way. And I don't really teach games that much anymore. I mean, my biggest thing would be the theme. When I do teach games, I try to make sure that when I'm teaching Root or something along those lines, I try to teach the mechanics through the lens of the storytelling and the theme and the way that things are flowing throughout the course of the game. But really, when it comes to structure and approach, I either stumble my way through it because I've just read the rule book, or I'm learning it from someone else.
My recommendation around teaching overall is something that I actually don't do, that I think more people should start practicing, and it's asking your players how they like to learn. For example, I have a big discrepancy in my game group. Jesse is the type of player that literally wants you to speed run as quickly as you can all the rules. And then you have other players that want to be taught like they've never played a game before. They want everything very consolidated, very well explained, calmly collected, and thorough. And that there's, and sometimes when those discrepancies happen at the same time, it's usually just better to get a feel for what's happening. Beyond that, beyond just asking your players and always asking questions in regards to that, I would say that the best way of doing any type of teaching is to involve the people that are around you at all times, making sure that, hey, stopping in the middle of a sentence or stopping after you explain a critical mechanic and say, hey, do you have a question? Do you want an example of this? What do you need in order to help this cement and so that we can get started? I'm making sure that you leave space for people to engage with you, and that is an active, it's an invitation always. And as well, always offering to have a quick round at the beginning. Sometimes getting the rules for a game can be particularly challenging or just a little bit daunting for a player. So it's always good to give them the space to fail at something before actually getting started with it.
And for me, my answer is going to be purely mechanical. My answer is just going to be about the process I utilize, which is going to be fairly straightforward. You start with how you win a game. So when you're bringing a game to the table, you simply say, okay, here's the game, here's the theme, here's how we're going to win. And from there, you go into turn structure, what happens in a given turn and how that process looks like, and then all the other peripheries. I personally find that when teaching a game, that general structure tends to give people a good, quick guideline as to what they're doing, why they're doing it, how to get there, as opposed to when someone starts explaining, well, you know, and here are the cards that do this and this and this, and you don't even understand what the end goal of why those cards exist or how they play into the game is. Start with your goal, start with your destination, and then proceed to guide them along that journey.
Yeah, and for me, I have a question from Aaron Taylor. What games do you leave set up for a quick game? This is going to be a very easy answer, Aaron. I currently live in a single bedroom in my parents' house. I don't leave any games set up for a quick game. I don't have the space to do so. But when I do finally move and have the space to leave a game on one designated table for unto perpetuity, it's not the word, but I tried,
Perpetuity.
Kingdom Death would be that title. Kingdom Death would be my lightweight, you know, seemingly accessible grab and go game. I think this question's inspired from our conversation around Shobu, though, to be fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For me, again, you're both going to give me flack for this, and Space Cats and Peace Turtles are too, but I backed a really neat chessboard, I think it was in 2019, or maybe early 2020.
Chess.
That you can, yes, it is a chessboard. It is a mechanical chessboard that can actually move pieces automatically and mechanically without another player.
I haven't heard of that before. Chess.
It's called the Neo Swap.
Computer game.
It's like the computer game chess. Is it inspired from the computer game chess?
I thought you were talking about the actual product. You're just joking about chess overall. Okay, I get it now. Mm-hmm. Either way, so that is the one that I always wanted to have. I've always wanted to have a beautiful chess set to go somewhere that anybody could just pick up. And this one, it's not necessarily the most pristine or the most elegant of all of them, but it's definitely the most innovative and cool. So I can't wait to get that one if it actually arrives at any point.
And for me, given your context about Shobu, I would answer Santorini. And to be clear, yep. I don't ever leave Santorini set up for a quick game. But if I were going to if I lived in a house without children who inevitably gets to all the things that are left set up, I would probably leave Santorini set up. The
game that would be looks my second appealing. Choice.
It's quick to play. It's fun. It's easy to teach. It's the kind of game that I can leave on the table halfway through a game with that beautiful idea of what's currently going on, of the puzzle being presented, have people ask a question and just say, hey, look, here's how a turn goes, and then proceed to dive into a full game.
Yep.
I think it's an excellent visually appealing and an easy to teach and easy to play game.
Yeah, Santorini's beautiful. That would genuinely be the second thing I go for. Probably, if just board games, it would be also Santorini.
And for my question, I'm going to bring in something from Corey, who says, some hobbyists are game collectors. Clearly, that's not any of you, because you wouldn't have shelf or sell otherwise. Excluding collectors and excluding content creators, how is a board game community maintained long term? And he proceeds to go on about the concept being presented, the question on the table is, how do you stay relevant in a hobby that is constantly adding new things to the table? How is your collection interesting and worthy of being talked about, worthy of picking out games and being played, if you're not constantly updating, if you're not constantly getting the new stuff, either for the collecting aspect, either just cycling? What do you do when your hobby, when the newest games you have are 3 years old? How do you stay relevant? And for myself, my answer is just going to be, the best games are often 3+ years old.
Yeah.
The Cult of the New is excellent, and I love the Cult of the New, don't get me wrong. But 80% of my gameplay is going to come from games that are older and have stayed around in my collection. We just talk more about the Cult of the New. But given a choice between pulling out a tried and true favorite, a game people have heard of, a game that has been validated time and time again, or playing one of those many new games that look cool but might be another letdown or might be amazing, ultimately, most of our gameplay in our group is the Cult of the Old. We just talk more about the Cult of the New.
I mean, I'm going to be honest. We do have a young industry that is swelling and blooming, and there's a lot of titles being released. But I would venture on the side of, if you want to have a respectable or responsible collection, one that is worth talking about, play games that are 3 years old only.
For me, I would say that one of the best advice that I've ever gotten about my collection was that one time one of my friends looked at it and was like, this collection isn't necessarily very welcoming of introductory players. You're focusing a lot on mid-tier and mid-weight games, and I don't see what game you can just pop out very quickly and play with anyone. And that sunk with me, and I started doing a little bit of research, and I changed that. So for me, the way that you stay relevant is just being able to cater to absolutely anybody that visits you and that wants to play a game. You always have an answer no matter what happens, regardless if it's a game that's 3 years old or a game that you find interesting today. I think it's just about creating the perfect ambiance and the perfect space for exploration and play.
Yeah, I mean, I think new games are wonderful. I think it's awesome. I love chasing what's new and playing the newest hotness. But the reason why I think if you want to build a respectable or worthwhile board game collection, instead of just being a collector or just chasing the Cult of the New, I think 3 years is a responsible window. Because, I mean, you have to think about it. There's 1,000+ titles being released every year. You know, 500 of those will kind of fall into the ether of never being talked about again after they've already been published. 20 or 30 of those will hit the conversation and last for the course of a couple of years and still be active parts of people's board game community and collections. And out of those, maybe 5 or 6 are gems that just everyone should own or add. And as that cycle moves forward, if you're playing older and more historical titles that have more context, more reviews, that have given you more opportunities to playtest them or experience them or discuss them with people, your collection is going to be a lot more refined and a lot more purposeful than people that are just chasing what's coming out currently.
Yeah, and ultimately, this hobby is one of the only entertainment hobbies that is doesn't really get old. Like, the older the game, the usually the better it's going to be. So I wouldn't necessarily worry about being relevant at all. Go for what you have fun with.
I'm really excited to see the longevity of this new game that I've heard about. Chess?